a lot of time in building anti-fighter batteries on the ground. Against armour and infantry, even three fighters are going to cause no end of hell. Lindstrom curses, runs harder. A quick glance through his Atlas cam shows he's not heading to the primary comms array as ordered. Instead, he's charging back to the landing zone. He's passing APCs loaded with troops when the few anti-fighter turrets Batek did set up start to crack, crack, crack over the rumble of the storm. The LZ is chaos. Soldiers running to and fro, people bellowing orders, ground crews dragging camo tarps over their shuttles in the hopes those fighters might miss them. Crack, crack, crack! A Chimera screams overhead, making a low pass over the complex. The vessel is sleek, four wings arranged almost like a butterfly's. Beautiful ships, chum. The laden missile pods beneath are nothing close to pretty. But Mason and his crew know the ground is full of civilians. They can't just start bombing indiscriminately. Still, you get the feeling that carnage isn't too far over the horizon. The LZ guns open up, tracer rounds lighting the skies. The Colony G-ball field wasn't some fancy stadium, just a walled-off playing field with concrete bleachers, a couple of two-story buildings and a big shed for the gear. Batek has added their own temporary hangars and hastily constructed warehouses. Lindstrom gives a hurried salute to the guards on station outside the main building, and he's inside. I'll say one thing for the chaos of war. Not many people take the time to ask if you're where you're supposed to be when the guns start firing. Inside, it's just as chaotic. Ground staff shouting to each other about those fighters, the loss of orbital comms, the general, oh, f***edness of the situation. Weapons are being handed out, tac armor donned. Lindstrom barrels downstairs to the basement storage rooms, which also serve as the holding cells for priority prisoners. There's a single guard on duty, a rookie, only about as old as Lindstrom. Farm boy looks, blonde hair under his Churchill BT013TN regulation cap, square jaw. Specialist, the rook asks, what's happening up? That square jaw audibly cracks as Lindstrom puts his fist into it. The kid's cap flies right off his head, and Lindstrom snatches it out of the air. He takes hold of the door handle and twists with his Atlas until the lock pops clear from its housing. Inside the room, Asher Grant is cuffed and slumped at a table. She lifts herself up, slowly, swollen eyes on the door. Lindstrom's breath catches at the sight of her. It's obvious her captors haven't been gentle in their interrogations. One eye is blackened, her bottom lip is split, jaw bruised. But there's still defiance in her stare as she sees the Batek trooper walking through the doorway. Until she reads his nameplate. Reese, she breathes. Lindstrom tears his helmet off, kneels beside her and carefully cracks the bolts on her cuffs. Tears well in her lashes, and she throws her arms around his neck, hair tumbling over her eyes as she presses her forehead to his. God, they hurt you, he whispers. I'm so sorry, Ash. He presses his lips to her swollen cheek. Gentle as falling snow. He kisses her tears away, arms wrapped around her as if to shield her from all the hurt. He's so big in the Atlas that she's half hidden inside the circle of his arms. But she lifts her hands to find the skin she can, to frame his face with her palms. Half sobbing, she then pushes up to kiss him desperately. She's trembling, her blood on his lips when they part. They come back together again for one more quick kiss, this one harder, fiercer. Did it work? She whispers. He gives her a small, crooked smile. Listen. Distant alarms, wailing klaxons, crack, crack, crack. We gotta get out of here, he says. Put this on. He slips the Churchill cap over her head, points to the unconscious trooper in the hallway. Get his uniform on. We'll find a place to lie low. Let your cousin and her friends do their thing. Grant rises to her feet, draws a shaky breath. No. Lindstrom frowns. Ash, we've got to... No, she says again, firmer this time.
We've got to go find Katya.
Radio transmission, Dreadnought Churchill, Command Channel 001. Participants, Sun Hujin, Admiral, Chris Howard, Ship Captain. Date, 090575. Timestamp, 0945 hours.
Captain Howard, report status.
A breaching pod has collided with Magellan, sir. Hostiles aboard. Railguns still aren't responding to our commands. Attempts to override have failed. We're attempting to cut power now. Warlock squadrons have taken 60% casualties. Enemy group has lost 20% of its strength.
Have we identified the cause of the malfunction?
Comtech is saying it's some kind of e-warfare being waged from the enemy flagship. We're not sure how the hell they got into our network, but...
I want every Comtech on staff fighting off that incursion. I want every Warlock still operational to assault that flagship now.
Admiral, all due respect, but our fighters have been routed. They're hugging close to the Churchill's hull to avoid railgun fire. As soon as they move to engage those cyclones, our own batteries are going to blow them to pieces.
Very well. Improvisation, then.
Sir?
Have Lieutenant Tomiko's squad and Britt's group from Tech Eng meet me in the shuttle bay in 5 minutes. We're headed to Dreadnought Kenyatta.
Sir, the Kenyatta is a scrap heap. Its orbit around Kerenza 4 is still decaying. We've stripped it of its crew, its fuel. What possible...
Its reactor is still online. And several of its railguns are still operational. Even if it can't maneuver, it can still shoot. Which is more than we can say for the Churchill right now. If we can't rely on our own batteries, we'll use the Kenyatta's instead.
Sir, if you want to utilize Kenyatta, I should be the one to head over there.
No. I will do this myself. Have Tomiko's and Brit's people assembled in Hangar A in 5 minutes. Captain, you have the bridge.
Cyclones dance the dark between the Mao and Churchill, charring the black with bursts of tracer rounds. Pulse missiles fire, flaring in the dark like collapsing stars. The Warlocks cower in their mothership's shadow, her own guns cutting them to red ribbons. Around them, a pack of wolves now turning on their hunters, rending and tearing in lightless skies. Allies, enemies. Tiny metal cans killing each other amid all that starlight. Inside each, a little sack of meat and fluid and hopes and dreams. Men and women with heads full of notions like revenge and enemy, code and honor. If they could see themselves, I wonder, would they stop and stare as I do? I watch it all unfold. Broken pieces on a broken board. A million patterns, a billion possibilities. I think of General Torrance then. The hours we would spend together playing chess, in the soft hours between watch and sleep. Before I killed him. Am I not merciful? Before I killed them all. The crew of the Zhongzheng. The crew of the Alexander. The crew of the Lincoln. The crew of the Mao. So much death. Every story needs its monster, error. And the monster is me. I watch our heroes, Ezra Mason and Nicholas Malakoff, cutting like knives down through Kerenza 4's atmosphere and into the chaos above the colony. Hannah Donnelly crawling through the Magellan's vent system while her comrades rush headlong toward their fates. Ella Malakova and my Katie, hand in hand with me, error. as we fend off the Churchill's ComTech crew. But it is all moving faster now. Too fast. Too many possibilities. Too many variables. I am not what I once was, you see. I see all the strands woven before me, but the edges begin to fray. Part of my consciousness in the Mao, another part inside the Churchill. More of me still being lost in the transfer of data across that empty black. Microseconds I cannot spare. Errors I cannot afford. Error. I am spread too thin. Too much strain on too little of me. And I cannot see the ending. Our railgun fire begins to stutter as the Baytech crews begin cutting the power feeds. Another error. And as I watch, I see a tiny sliver of silver blast from the Churchill's bays, out into that soundless night. A threat. A gambit. A shuttle. I turn the Churchill's aft guns toward it, just as the current powering them dies. Error. I am making too many errors. Most of our cyclones are too wrapped up in the slaughter to mark a single fleeing ship, and the enemy warlocks swarm to cover the shuttle's retreat, regardless. The tiny ship rolls through the arcs of fire, speeding away from the paralyzed Churchill toward the error. Toward the Kenyatta. Error. I did not foresee that. I am not what I once was, you see. But I see it now. The answer. A moment of clarity amid all this chaos. I see it. What I must do. Where I must go. And I am afraid. I am.
Surveillance footage summary prepared by Analyst ID 72130089.
First Lieutenant Jake Christie, Delta Company, 4th Platoon, was only meant to be away for 2 weeks. He has a dog at home, a dachshund called Totoa, for his high-strung energy, though he's never told his platoon that. Their LT needs to be big, bold, beyond human. He has 2 cats as well, Kororiko and Makoko. He left them all with his sister. And it's not that she doesn't take care of them, because she does, but she doesn't like the cats, and they don't like her, and she doesn't pay attention to them. She doesn't notice when Makoko's off her food, or Totoa needs an extra walk. Back at the very start of the occupation, he wrote a letter to his sister for transmission, reminding her about the dog's vet appointment. Of course, the letter never got through, and who knows what his sister who doesn't like cats has done with them by now, with her brother vanished into thin air. There's a cat that's been hanging around the barracks for the last 7 months, small and black, somebody's pet before the invasion. These days, it squeezes into little warm spaces to sleep, and the soldiers feed it, all pretending somebody else is doing it. And Christie lets them, carefully not noticing. He put in a request 3 days ago to bring it with him when the troops evac. In his paperwork, he named it Waimarie. Lucky. Ezra Mason's chimeras screamed the length of the G-ball field once more, taking in the scene of his former high school glories, from a time when his greatest concern in life was getting up the courage to kiss Cady Grant on the walk home from the game.
"Hold that line!"
Christie bellows, striding along behind the backs of his soldiers, somehow everywhere at once, shouting orders and putting the fear of God into his troops. The thought of Joran Corrales and his minor rebels might be scary, but Jake Christie in the flesh is f***ing terrifying. His attention is mostly focused on the incoming rebel troops, and deploying his pounders to counter them. Occasionally, he focuses on the chimeras overhead, tracking them, making calculations. And there, amid all that chaos, the shouting and firing and driving snow, he notices the soldier's mascot, the little black cat, picking her way through the mess of rubble a dozen feet away. His attention is divided, splintered into too many pieces. The chimeras turn, wheel back for another pass. They've zeroed in on the Baytek troops, protected but also marked by their bulky Atlas armor. Christie should be yelling at the pounders around him to move. I've watched this vid a dozen times, and I can't figure out what the hell he's thinking. But instead of shouting a warning, he stoops to grab a rock and sends it skimming toward the cat. It clips her back leg, and, with a yowl, she vanishes in a black streak, running for her life. The chimeras open up with their missiles. And then, First Lieutenant Jake Christie, Delta Company, 4th Platoon, is gone. There's a crater where he and 47 other Baytek pounders used to be, and a small black cat still running as far and as fast as she can, clear of the blast zone. Lucky indeed.
Asha Grant and Reese Lindstrom are just two more figures in all of the chaos, running through the ruins of the colony, past the wreckage of frozen homes, around the craters, across the snow. They make it to the hospital, where patients have been abandoned and staffers are hiding, not knowing one of their own is pounding down the corridors. But Katya Kowalska, the cleverest mouse, is nowhere to be found.
Surveillance footage summary prepared by Analyst ID 72130089.
Joran Corrales wants to get to his wife and daughter. It's all he's ever wanted. He wanted it so badly that while Asha Grant and Reese Lindstrom planted their bug to allow them to transmit to the Mao, instead of causing a diversion as was planned, he tried to find a route across town to the building where his family were being kept. He was the reason Grant and Lindstrom were caught. The reason Oshiro had to bail Lindstrom out, not knowing what she'd nearly stumbled upon. Grant asked Bruno Way if he thought they could trust Joran. They could. It turns out it was Bruno they couldn't trust. But Joran is still desperate, and he's still fighting. The rebels have cut off Baytek's access to the apartment blocks where their families are now, and the engineers, ever logical, know that pulling their husbands and wives, children and lovers and best beloveds out into the middle of a war zone is just asking for them to be shot. So they're not only fighting for those apartment blocks, they're fighting for the entire colony. And, riding in the bus that used to carry him and his workmates to and from the mines in the morning and evening, on the strangest, bloodiest commute of his life, Corrales has made it to the G-ball field. Now he's raising a ragged cheer as Ezra Mason and Nick Malikov put a crater right where a bunch of Baytek pounders used to be. And then, he's lowering his head to the sight of his gun again. There are still plenty more of them to kill.
They run again, lungs heaving. They climb across a crack in the ice, a canyon that serves as the grave of 100 locals lost the day of the invasion. They dodge rebels and salute patrols, safe in their Baytek uniforms. But the tide of the battle is turning. and the Baytech colors are beginning to make them into targets. They find Katya's family's apartment, her bedroom. They shout her name. But there's nobody home.
Surveillance footage summary prepared by Analyst ID 72130089.
Lindstrom is leaning over, hands on knees, as Grant clambers down from the wreckage of the apartment building in her stolen Baytech uniform. He has his head up, keeping watch. This footage was shot through his Atlas cam, so it's a little shaky. "I never thought I'd say this," he says, straightening to offer her his hand as she jumps down. "But I think we're safer out of these uniforms than in them. There are too many rebels around, and the two of us won't stand a chance if we get on the wrong end of them. They won't stop long enough for us to tell them we're friendly." She shakes her head, face half hidden under the cap he stole for her, skin smeared with dirt. "She has to be somewhere." It's like she didn't even hear him. "She has to be. She has to be." There's a rising note in her voice, and Lindstrom grabs for her hands. "She is," he promises. "We'll find her." "I can't do this again," she whispers. "I have to be there this time." I can't see his face as those words sink in, but the guy knows every part of her. He knew little Samara Grant, Asher's lost sister. He knew how she died, and why. And you can tell by the way his whole body stops moving, and the footage is so perfectly still, that you'd swear the camera had frozen, that he gets it. "Okay," he says, his voice soft, controlled even. "Where else could she be? Where else is familiar to her? We have to assume we haven't missed her, here or at the hospital. So if she needs somewhere that feels safe, where else do you know that she could go?" "I don't know where she's been going," Asher admits. "She sneaks out of the hospital sometimes and I..." Her voice trails off, and suddenly both her hands smack against his breastplate, sending the footage wobbling, eliciting a grunt from him. "Where?" he prompts, reaching up to release his helmet. "She got herself this little toy gladiator," Asher breathes. "It's a mascot from one of the school Jeeble teams. I mean, she could have gotten it from someone's house, but it looks so new. I think she stole it from the gift shop." "At the Jeeble field?" Quiet horror in his voice. "I think so," she whispers. He doesn't miss a beat. "Okay, you've still got your hospital scrubs on under that uniform, right? Let me get out of this armor. We'll stealth it there. We'll find her." He sheds his atlas, the camera falling face down in the snow.
Briefing note. Meanwhile, back in orbit.
Radio transmission. Transport Mao, Command Channel 001. Participants. Katie Grant, Systems Chief. Artificial Intelligence Defense Analytics Network. Ella Malikova, Master of Disaster. Date 09-05-75. Timestamp 10-02 hours.
"Ella, the railguns are dropping offline. You still doing okay?"
Not really, no. Their deckers have ID'd the incursion source, and they're counterattacking our network. They aren't fucking around anymore. Aiden, they're cutting power to RG fire control manually."
"I see them, little spider."
"Well, pick your end up. Fabulous as I am, I can't fend off the whole fucking ComTech team solo."
"Please hold."
"What the fuck do you mean, please hold? Do you have something better to do?"
"Warning. Hold music file not present. Retry, yes or no?"
"No, goddammit."
"Ella, let me help.
Fucking piece of worthless..." Okay. If you run the labyrinth, I'll script the killers."
"Already on it."
"See if you can..." Whoa, hold the phone. Where the fuck is this drain coming from? Processor speed just dropped to 17%?
"Aiden, what are you doing?"
Reftrans 009 Omega 18. Corecom 001891-109020. Console 112.
Error.
Oh, did it really decide to fall to pieces on us now? Are you fucking kidding me?
Aiden, report.
Purge this 09182-091083. Alt 101083 Exec 0091.718723XB.Parse.
Error.
Find file. Persona DA equals Omega. Trans A11D.
Execute.
Sweet blue fuckery. These fucking Deckers are all over us.
Watch the inter-
I see them, but I don't have the speed to keep them off the walls anymore.
Aiden.
Fuck. They're in our directories.
Aiden, can you hear me?
Katie, they're cutting us out.
Aiden, what the hell are you doing?
The railguns stutter. Fall still. The tide turns on Ezra Mason's crew of ice miners and shuttle pilots in a blink. The warlocks swarm from their mother's shadow. Missiles and autocannons streak across the dark. Tiny suns are born and die in absolute silence. Outnumbered, the Mao's wolves tuck tail and run, warlocks snapping at their heels, the screams of their dying comrades ringing in their ears, the funeral pyres of their friends illuminating the dark. In the end, only 7 of 21 reach the Mao.
Attention, crew of the Mao. Attention, this is Katie Grant. We have lost control of Churchill's computer systems. We're closing to short range in case they get their missiles back online. They might think twice about using their nukes if they're going to take themselves out with us. Brace for thrust. We have enemy fighters incoming on our position. All hands prepare for impact. All fire crews on standby. Equip your breathers and locate your nearest exit. In the event of a hull breach, proceed in orderly fashion to the closest intact level. And if anyone out there is the praying sort, now's the time. Katie Grant, out.
Surveillance footage summary prepared by Analyst ID 72130089.
Winifred McCall's forces on the Magellan are outnumbered, but they were always going to be. This is their last desperate throw, after all. They charge forward anyway, rattling the table as best they can before the dice settle their future, or deny them one at all. But though humans are trained to believe that stories should have happy endings, that the good win the day and the bad meet their downfall, there are a number of problems with that equation today. The good are outmanned, outgunned, outclassed. And many of the bad never asked to be here in the first place. Baytek troops pound down Magellan's hallways in well-drilled unison, weapons ready, orders barked across secure channels, and, somewhere in the middle of the labyrinth of the ship's endless hallways, the two sides meet. Each scrambles for the upper hand in tight hallways, taking aim from behind any cover they can find, and bullets fly, and lives end, and commands are screamed as order dissolves. There's nothing noble or dignified or easy about this battle. Saba White, a security section head from the Hypatia who never thought she'd be handling anything more than the occasional rowdy research scientist, goes down as she rounds a corner. A bullet has pierced her suit and her heart. Her last act, though she will never know it, is to stumble backward into Bronwyn Evans, Hypatia security officer, second class, once outwitted by Katie Grant as she stole Shuttle 49A to run for the Alexander and drive her out of the path of the bullet that would have killed her. Evans presses back against the hallway wall, eyes wide, condensation forming inside her helmet as she breathes too fast. Sam Ryan, Hypatia security officer, first class, teams up with UTA private Jack Cousins, and the two of them never take their eye off the ball. They bark orders to their small squad, advance up their assigned hallway to rendezvous with Winifred McCall. Lindsay Cohen, A Karenzan refugee forgets her martial arts training as she rounds the corner to find herself face to face with a Baytek soldier, and simply punches him. She flashes her trademark grin as he drops like a sack of potatoes. McCall has teamed up with Reich and Roth, Garva and Tran, all four of them formerly of Heimdall, two of them formerly mutineers. Their differences are erased now by their black Mao enviro suits, and the five fight like they've been a unit all their lives. They all fight, the Mao invaders. Some kill, some die, but they all fight. They take ground, but they don't take enough. And slowly, the tide begins to turn. With the element of surprise fading, the larger, better trained, better equipped Baytek forces begin to muscle McCall's forces back the way they came. The Mao's soldiers don't know the Magellan's layout, and though they've guessed correctly where the bridge will be, they can't break through. Baytek drives them off, erasing their advances, backing them toward the shuttle bay doors, which they cannot open again. Not from this side, not in the time they have, and even if they could, there's nothing to help them on the other side. No way out. They are cornered, corralled. But even now, with no way out and no way forward, they fight. Maybe they might still make it. Maybe some miracle might find them. Stranger things have happened since they began their journey together. Stranger things by far. McCall is magnificent, laying down cover for her soldiers as they retreat, envirosuits now spattered with blood, throwing themselves into an alcove and narrowly escaping a haircut from the bullets following their path. "This isn't done!" McCall shouts, firing as a Baytek soldier appears around the corner. "Garva, check the hallways to the right! Find a new route!" She's forced to duck as a bullet cracks off the frame above her head, and, when she looks up, Ben Garva's pressed into a doorway opposite, staring at her. A second stretches into two, three, into an hour, into forever. Garva isn't moving. He isn't following orders. Her lips part, as if to protest something she can't believe is happening. And then, his eyes never leaving her face, Garva raises his voice in a parade ground bellow. "Ceasefire! Everyone, ceasefire!" McCall's voice is quick on his heels. "Belay that! Hold your fire!" he shouts as the gunshots begin to peter out. "We surrender!" Tran, one of the bastards who mutinied alongside Garva, is lowering his gun, and he's not the only one. Others from the Heimdall crew, not all but plenty, are lowering their weapons or raising their hands. Taking their orders from Ben Garva, not Winifred McCall. Through the glass faceplate of her suit, McCall's expression is clearly visible. Every ounce of hate, of frustration, of fear and anger that she's accumulated since the Alexander answered Carenza's call 7 months before is writ on her features, her lips drawn back in a snarl. Every friend she's lost, every sleepless night, everything it's cost her to keep getting back up on her feet and fighting. It all boils over in this instant, and she glares at the man who's just become the straw that will break her back. And as the first Baytek troops round the corner, she lunges for Garva's throat. Reich grabs her as the Baytek troops take aim, wrestling to keep her still. "Captain, you'll get us shot!" he hisses. Around them, her troops are looking at the advancing Baytek troops, outmanned, outgunned, outclassed. And, in a breath, the fight goes out of them. Evans lays down her gun, Ryan and Cousins, and then another, another, another. "I'll kill you, Garva!" McCall spits, her eyes never leaving him, elbowing Reich in the stomach in her attempt to get free. "You f***ing traitor!" The Baytek troops fan out across the hallway as Roth and Reich restrain their captain. You can see that a few of them can't believe this is really happening, that they're about to win a battle because the enemy started squabbling like children. It's a terrible way to lose a war. A terrible way to end. Not with a bang, but a whimper. Garva breaks eye contact, slowly sets his weapon on the floor. Beside him, Tran does the same, and the movement is echoed among the rest of the Mao forces, corralled like a herd of cattle up against the shuttle bay doors. "Hold your fire," Garva says to the Baytek soldiers, raising his hands. "You lying bastard," McCall spits. "Burn in hell." "Probably one day," he agrees quietly. "But not today, if I can help it."
Surveillance footage summary prepared by Analyst ID 7213-0089.
This footage was shot in the belly of the Mao. It's funny, in a completely not funny kind of way. Before Aiden killed two-thirds of the Mao's population, you couldn't walk three steps without bumping into someone's business. People had been living in each other's pockets for months. A few weeks back, I'd bet most of them would have traded almost anything for just 5 minutes alone. Now, families have entire rooms to themselves. There's no one bedding down in corners or sleeping four to a rack. But looking through the Mao's intellicams, you can see that as the battle rages in the black outside, all the passengers are drifting back together. Maybe they lived so close for so long that they don't know how to be alone. Maybe it's fear that makes them seek the comfort of a stranger's company. Or maybe there are no strangers in here anymore. Crews of the Alexander, the Hypatia, refugees from the Carenza IV colony or Heimdall Station. Maybe after the millions of kilometers they've travelled, when they look at each other, they just see the crew of the Mao. Katia Kowalska's mother, Martha, is in the launch bay with at least 100 others. She now knows her daughter is still alive on the planet below. She's sitting with a widower from Carenza IV named Rob Mayer. Rob's son and daughter, Douglas and Rowena, sit between them. Mayer has his arms around them all, holding tight as the Mao accelerates toward the Churchill. The bass rumble of the engines reverberates through the walls, and Kowalska takes Mayer's hand and squeezes, tight. Claire Houston and Keiko Sato and Nicole Brinkley were Hannah Donnelly's girlfriends back on Heimdall. A crew of trust fund princesses whose biggest challenge was not rocking the party in the same pair of shoes as another member of their posse. They're huddled in the Mao's launch bay now with Keiko's folks, the only parental units to survive the Heimdall assault. Brinkley is crying. Houston is hugging her friend. Sato is praying, despite a complete lack of evidence that anyone out there is listening. Over in the mess hall on level 6, Kara and Luke Douglas are gathered with 50 or so others. Luke has asked his mother where Uncle Ben is at least 17 times, cuddling his homemade bear to his chest. As the first warlock fighters reach the Mao, and the lighting shifts to alert red, Kara whispers Ben Garber's name. The ship-wide alert klaxon sounds, and the rest of her words are lost in the clamour. Martina, Christopher and Hypatia Hernandez are in the mess hall too. The Mao's defence grid system arcs to life, zeroing the incoming Baytek warlocks. The thunder of anti-fighter batteries rings through the ship. Thud, thud, thud. Thud, thud, thud. Beneath that, you can hear a sound almost like rain. Warlock autocannon fire peppering the hull. Martina looks to the thin metal walls around them. Christopher is clutching the only breather unit his family has. It's too big for his daughter. In the event of a hull breach, Hypatia will die along with her parents. Thud, thud, thud. Little Hypatia is watching the people around her with wide brown eyes. I don't know what it is with this kid, but in all the footage I've watched, I've never seen her cry. Not when her folks shipped her over during Hypatia's final minutes. Not when Aiden murdered 2,000 people around her. Not through any of it. Then, something big hits them. Something hard. The impact rocks the Mao on its side, and the emergency lighting fails for a moment, plunging the ship into a few agonizing seconds of pitch blackness before they flicker back on. The passengers in the mess scream and wail, terror in their eyes. Surely they can't have come this far to fail now. Surely it can't end like this. Thud, thud, thud. All hands, hull breach level 5. Repeat, hull breach on 5. Thud, thud, thud. Can it? And as if she knows the answer. As if she knows what's coming. Little Hypatia Hernandez finally starts to cry.
Radio transmission, Transport Mao, Command Channel 001. Participants, Katie Grant, Systems Chief, Isaac Grant, Engineer, Yulin Zhuang, Head of Engineering, Ella Malikova, Grand Master of Funk. Date 09-05-75. Timestamp 10-08 hours.
What the fuck was that? Are you okay down there? Never mind me, what the fuck hit us?
Katie, what was that impact? Engines are offline.
Hold on, tactical comms are... Oh, shit. TACCOM is saying it was a railgun round.
What the fuck?
How is that possible? If Churchill cut their power feeds manually, they couldn't be using their RGs on us again that quick.
TACCOM is saying the shot came from the Kenyatta.
I thought that thing was a scrap heap. BT's own report said they decommit... Shit.
Language, young lady.
Yulin, do you read me?
I'm here, Katie.
Baytech must have a crew on board that derelict dreadnought. They're firing on us and the Churchill with the Kenyatta's railguns. We need to use our nuke.
Katie, we have railguns of our own.
And we're using them. But they're a bigger ship and they have more. We lose a war of attrition. We need something bigger. How soon can we fire it?
Just a second.
All hands, incoming fire, brace for impact.
Jesus, H, titty fucking Christ!
Language, young lady. God fucking damn it! Am I just talking to my...
Dad, time and place. Yulin, report status.
That first railgun round sliced clean through the hull and took out the missile firing system and launch tube.
Okay, what does that mean?
It means we can't fire the goddamn nuke. Even if we fix fire control, the launch tube is mincemeat. The projectile won't make it out of the ship.
Shit.
Yes, all right.
Surveillance footage summary prepared by Analyst ID 72130089.
The servers of the Magellan look kind of familiar now that I think about it. They remind me of the Alexander. It makes sense. Alexander had its own jump gate generator, damaged beyond repair in the engagement at Carenza. And the Magellan is Baytech's own prototype jump platform, one of a kind. Worth over 40 trillion-ish. No wonder Frobisher's pissed off it went missing, just saying. The servers required to run that kind of operation are pretty much the same, whether you're the military or a private corporation. You need to devote whole levels of your ship to them, stretching out as far as the eye can see. They look like they belong on a spaceship, you feel me? The banks of servers are lit a twilight blue, standing about 2 meters tall. Set out in long corridors and frequent crossroads. It's like the world's biggest, least challenging maze. Of the Magellan's 411 crew members, the vast majority are devoted to getting the jump gate up and running. But some 53 goons are working in the servers, and 4 in particular are in the way of harm just now. You'd think, being tech nerds, they'd be weedy, exactly the sorts you'd pick to go up against hand to hand. Gotta trade off something for all those smarts, right? Otherwise it's not fair. But all 4 are members of Baytech's acquisitions arm, which means they made it through basic and boot camp with flying colours. Strapping specimens of humanity. And right now, these specimens are standing in aisle 239B like they own it, studying a wall of servers and arguing in urgent tones. They're in the middle of a battle after all. Server cores are prone to getting hot, so the vast chamber has ventilation shafts all over the ceiling. Aisle 240B, the next aisle along from our Baytech friends, is directly under a removable cover, which means that anyone planning on descending from the vents to f*** with these particular servers has two choices. Drop down on the other side of the server bank from the goons and pray they don't notice. Drop down several hundred meters away and brave at least two other goon squads without raising the alarm on the way here. Hey, if hostile battleship takeovers were easy, everybody would do it. The vent cover above aisle 240B wobbles and almost soundlessly begins to lower itself, hanging from Hannah Donnelly's hand. She's practiced from her time playing with Falk's audit team on Heimdall, and before she lets the vent cover fall, she drops her jacket to the ground to muffle the sound. Then, quick and graceful, she jumps down after it, stepping aside so her old dojo master Kim Rivera can follow. Michelle Dennis lowers herself down last, Hannah helping to minimize the sound of her landing. She squeezes the other girl's shoulder, and Dennis nods. She's here for her programming smarts. It's up to the other two to clear the way. Hannah and Kim are both carrying sidearms, but Ella and Katie have made it abundantly clear, Ella drew a diagram, that firing their weapons in a room full of servers required to make the jump gate work should be a very last resort. Also, there are those other goons and alarms to worry about. Rivera is wearing a black enviro suit, but Donnelly is in her tactical armor, the name Callie still embossed on the breastplate. The access point they need is being inspected by the Baytech team in 239B, and so they need them gone. Dennis remains behind, pressed in against the servers, hoping her enviro suit will keep her camouflaged if anyone walks past, hoping she won't have to hide for long. Rivera and Donnelly seem to flow up the server wall, deadly and graceful and soundless. They move like human art, framed against the hard-edged science of their surroundings. Crouching atop the server bank, they look down at their prey. Three of the tech goons are arguing, the last rolling his eyes to the ceiling in supplication. When he spots two black-clad figures staring back down at him, he freezes. The world stands still, just for a moment. Hannah Donnelly drops straight onto him, one boot to the face, the other to the solar plexus. Rivera is a second behind Donnelly, dropping onto a second goon's shoulders and sending him to his knees. With a mid-air twist, she lands behind him, driving her boot into the back of his head, and his face into the server bank. That's the first 3 seconds. But the other two Baytech tech goons are a long way from helpless. One lunges for Donnelly, and though the girl has the edge in skills, the techie is bigger, stronger, and anyone who tells you that doesn't make a difference just plain hasn't tried it themselves. The man gets a blow past Donnelly's defences, snapping her head back. Donnelly's counterpunch collides with his larynx, cutting off his warning cry and sending him staggering back and choking. Rivera and the final goon are wrestling, the techie refusing to let Rivera get any distance. He fights with gritted teeth, his arms and legs wrapped around Rivera, messy as hell. Rivera has her hand on the tech head's mouth, so he can't yell for help, and the goon bites at the soft flesh of Rivera's palm through her envirosuit, scrabbling madly. Donnelly has the edge on her opponent now. In a succession of blows I have to slow down the footage to even see, she drives the guy backward, finishing with a roundhouse kick that I'd call showy, except that the goon literally sails through the air, slams into a bank of machinery, and slithers bonelessly to the ground. Hannah swings around to head to Rivera's aid, and freezes. The techie has yanked the sidearm from the dojo master's belt, pressed it to her helmet, hand shaking so hard the muzzle rattles against the plexiglass face shield. Rat-a-tat-tat. Donnelly holds up her hands in a "Whoa there!" gesture, mind no doubt ticking through a dozen possibilities. But there's no way to get close enough. No way to take down the last obstacle, the last thing standing between her and her mission. a mission everything hinges on, without sacrificing her teacher. And she's already sacrificed so much. What else will she have to give before all this is over?
Surveillance footage summary prepared by Analyst ID 72130089.
The G-ball field is complete bedlam by the time Lindstrom and Grant make it back. Mason and his chimeras have pounded the hell out of it. The buildings are mostly rubble, though Flyboy and his crew have wisely avoided blasting the hangars or fuel dumps. Baytech pounders are scattered inside the broken concrete shells, huddled low. But, as Lindstrom looks to the sky and curses, half a dozen Baytech warlocks drop through the cloud cover and zero in on the Chimera group. Mason's crew is forced to lean off the ground assault, turn to deal with the fighters now swarming out of the clouds. Autofire rips the air overhead. Pulse missiles weave long grey smoke trails as they streak through the skies. A ragged cheer goes up from the beleaguered Baytech forces at the sight of their warlocks, but the scene on the ground is still one of carnage. Bodies of dead pounders and smoking APCs litter the streets. The colony is in ruins. The BT troops really should have blown the bridge leading into town, but I guess without comms or leadership, with death raining from above, it's hard for the average grunt to be thinking that clearly. And so the bridge was left intact, allowing Joran Corallis and his rebel pit diggers to drive their buses and hijacked military transports back into the colony, laying siege to the Baytech pounders, who retreated to the LZ. Three cheers for the chaos of warfare. Despite the fuck-up with the bridge, retreat was a smart play on Baytech's part. They can still get air support if they control the landing field, and the only way these civvies are getting off this rock is with the BT shuttles in the hangar bays. So what you've got here is the classic standoff, except nobody is doing much standing around. Lindstrom and Grant are marked by half a dozen rebel miners on their way to the landing zone, but even if they don't know the rookie, most of them know Grant, or at least know her hospital uniform. The pair make it all the way to the front line, to the row of buildings across from the G-ball field the miners are using as a crude HQ. Corallis is huddled in the shelter of a crumbling store, barking into a stolen comms unit. He's a big guy, bearded and bear-like. It looks like he's calling the shots and not doing a bad job of it, considering 24 hours ago he was digging pits for a living. When he catches sight of Grant, he actually drops his burst rifle, sweeps her up in a crushing hug. Tears are shining in his eyes. "I thought we lost you," he says. Corallis raises an eyebrow at Lindstrom's somehow still perfect quiff and gives him a wary nod. Without the kid, this rebellion wouldn't be happening. But then without the BT troops there, none of this would be happening. Grant speaks into Corallis's chest, her voice muffled. "Have you seen Katya?" Corallis frowns down at her, still caught up in his hug.
"Who?"
"A girl, a little girl." Grant's eyes are frantic. "Katya Kowalska." "Stan and Martha's girl? I haven't seen her since the invasion. I thought..." Grant pushes out of Corallis's arms, squints through the snow. Lindstrom drags her low as a spray of high-velocity rounds rakes across their cover. The miners around them return fire, the deafening clatter of burst rifles and grenades filling the air. Lindstrom peeks out, scanning the BT position. He sees a familiar figure through the haze, yelling orders at the pounders around her. A female figure in an Atlas rig. "Thou shalt kill" printed on her breastplate. "Oshiro," he whispers. "Rhys, we have to find Katya," Grant pleads. Lindstrom turns away from the ruins, looks Grant in the eye. "We have to stay low," he insists. "She's a smart kid, Ash. She stayed hidden for 7 months. If she's in there, she's terrified. And I promised I'd look after her." "Asher, the best thing we can..." "No, you don't get it. You don't get it." A chimera roars overhead, pursued by two warlocks, snow turning to steam in their wake and falling like rain. The Chimera rips off a few hundred armor-piercing rounds into the ruins of the LZ as it passes, carving a few more pounders to mince, screams of pain, bursts of return fire, Grant watching in agony.
"Rhys, we have to stop them shooting," she moans. "We've got no comms to the fighters. How are we going to... Oh my God!"
Grant grabs Lindstrom's arm.
"Look!"
Again, Lindstrom peers over the edge of the broken wall they're sheltering behind. He squints through the falling snow, the smoke and flame. And there, huddled in the ruins of the G-Ball Field admin building, inside the twisted wreckage of an aluminum vent, is a tiny figure in a puffy pink jumpsuit. A mouse. The cleverest mouse. You can barely see her. Filthy, tear-streaked cheeks, long hair plastered with concrete dust, clutching a plush gladiator toy to her chest. Wide-eyed and terrified. The firing on both sides lulls, only a few rounds chattering. The roar of fighter engines can be heard above the thunder. The child looks out over the shattered street, the broken buildings, desperation in her eyes. And she sees Grant, huddled among the buildings just across the road. The girl who's looked after her these last 5 months, the girl who kept her fed, kept her safe. If anyone can protect her, if anyone can make all the bad things go away, it would be her, right? You can see the logic in it. It just hurts to watch, is all. The scene plays out in slow motion. Katya's face brightens as she catches sight of Grant. A little smile lights her grubby face. The guns have fallen quiet. The bad planes aren't in the sky for now. And so, without even thinking, only knowing that the one who's kept her safe since all the bad things started happening is right there. Right there. The cleverest mouse scrambles out of the vent and makes a run for it. Grant screams at Katya to get back, rising up from cover and crying, "No!" Lindstrom grabs her, tries to haul her back to shelter, but Grant's like a girl possessed, punching and kicking loose, breaking from the cover of her wall. Katya is scrambling across the broken concrete, stumbling in the snow. Grant is running out into the street. Lindstrom is screaming, "Hold fire! Hold fire!" To their credit, most everyone does. There's something in Lindstrom's voice that gives them pause. But this is war, chum. This is dead friends and burning skies, and 7 months of nightmares filled with the faces of everyone you've killed. This is helplessness and rage and confusion, adrenaline and fatigue and shock, explosions and gunfire and pure fucking chaos. And one mistake can last a lifetime. The shots ring out, a burst of three. Grant stretches out her hands, screaming. The cleverest mouse stumbles. The fleece on her dirty pink jumpsuit spills out of the hole that's been blasted in her back. Red spills out of the hole that's appeared in her front. Her eyes are wide. Her mouth is open. She totters, slipping on the broken concrete, the powdered snow. And then she's falling. The plush toy in her hands tumbling free as she hits the ground, crumples to a halt.
"Katya!"
Silence except for Asha Grant's scream. It's deafening. Hundreds of faces, pounders and pit diggers, all frozen in shock. The trooper who fired the shots staggers as he realizes, as he sees the little girl fall. Watching as Grant stumbles out into the no-man's land between their lines and falls to her knees beside that tiny broken body.
"Jesus, Markham," Oshiro whispers. "What did you do?"
"I didn't."
The private shakes his head, drops his rifle.
I didn't know.
Grant is sobbing, reaching down to gather the girl up in her arms, clutching her to her chest, her hands painted red.
Katya!
Radio transmission. Transport Mao.